GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Made public now after it was played in a courtroom yesterday, Donald Trump testimony, ABC's Aaron Katursky.
The former president of the United States answering questions in a deposition about a rape he insists he never committed, saying of his accuser, E. Jean Carroll, she's not my type.
We have in front of you a black and white photograph that we've marked as DJT-23.
When asked to identify the woman in the picture, Trump mistakes Carroll for his ex-wife, Marla Maples.
It's Marla.
Trump continues to insist he didn't rape Carroll because of the way she looks, even after he confused her for his ex-wife.
Pleading not guilty, the 21-year-old former University of California Davis student accused of 3 stabbings in the area, 2 fatal, with COVID-era restrictions on asylum seekers expiring next Thursday. The White House announces a plan to continue a deal with Mexico, Mexico accepting migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela that the U.S. sends back over the border. This is ABC News. A bit more in the better-than-expected jobs report from the Labor Department for April. 253,000 jobs were added last month. ABC News business correspondent Alexis Christophorus.
We saw that wages month over month up 0.5%, year over year up 4.4%. So wages not keeping up with inflation, but still ticking up a little bit.
Among the jobs that were added were those in professional and business services, healthcare, leisure, and hospitality. More on the soap opera angle of tomorrow's coronation of King Charles from ABC News royal correspondent Robert Jobson.
I think there's going to be a hugely patriotic moment for the British people and for the people of the other realms. But I do think we're in a moment of transition in the monarchy, and I think that the palace shouldn't be complacent at the moment, because a lot of younger people are not really enamoured with the idea of monarchy. They were quite disappointed with what happened with Harry and Meghan, for example. You know, Meghan, they feel, got a rough ride. And a lot of people thought Harry was really the only one who was in touch.
Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Are record high energy and water costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive. While you may not ask for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to be without heat, water, or power. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.heat.help. That's www.heat.help.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Now we wait to hear from a Madison judge about the future of the legal case to overturn Wisconsin's abortion ban. There was a hearing yesterday on a motion to have the suit dismissed. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Hall says abortion needs to be legal here again.
To protect the safety and the health of women in Wisconsin, but also to make sure that our medical professionals are able to act when they need to protect the health and the safety of women in the state.
The case is expected to go all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. A new study shows drinking went up in Wisconsin during the coronavirus pandemic. The highest increase happened in the first few months for people between 21 and 40. University of Wisconsin researchers blame stress and anxiety. In sports, the Bucks are in the market for a new head coach. They fired Mike Budenholzer yesterday. The Brewers are at San Francisco tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the grave digger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standing room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come ticket.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football, fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Did you know your favorite shows and hosts are active on social media too? Find Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and be part of the conversation happening there. And go to our website, civicmedia.us, to learn more about the Civic Media Network.
Guild has put on the table reasonable, a way forward, a way for the studios to make a ton of money like they are, and for the writers to make a living. Now, again, as I've been saying for a very long time, the wealth class in this country, they want to make a killing. And that means us. Most working people just want to make a living. That's it. Put food on the table, support the kids, little retirement stuff, you know, that kind of stuff. And the phrase that I keep seeing coming up, and we're going to talk a lot about this, is we're in a moment that this is an existential crisis. You know, with streaming and with AI and all the other tech things that are going on in the industry, I think the writers see in neon lights the future and not the kind of marquees that they're used to, which is why they're taking the kind of stand that they are. Now, the economics of it are clear. Every strike comes down to wages, hours, conditions, all of them. It just is what it is. This one's no different. They want more money. Because they're going broke. This is the first strike in 15 years. And as one person told me, they're again, the same issues over compensation, over streaming, that stuff. On the pay front, this is what caught my attention. 10 years ago, you had about a third of the writers, the TV writers, who earned the union minimum. Working their way up, maybe on a show that didn't have as big a budget, you know, whatever the cause, they were at the minimum. There's the bottom, a third. It's now almost 50%. So what's happening is these writers are being squeezed. They're being pushed to do more with less. And look, their wages have gone down. According to the Writers Guild, thanks to inflation, the writers' pay has declined 14% in the last 5 years. The weekly median income for a writer producer, down 23% over the last decade. And look, you know, you've got all these members who are struggling to make ends meet, struggling to make a living wage. And they're saying enough. We want better wages. We want better health care. We want, you know, better pensions. So we want to make our economic lives better. Because what's happened is the way these writers of the past had been paid out, it was, look, if you got a TV show in syndication, you got a TV show in reruns, sold something overseas, whatever. Somebody picked it up. Someone was paying you for it. And you did really well. It meant really good paydays that they earned. With all this streaming stuff, everybody's ripping off the writers and the producers. It's kind of like the... you know, the factory job where the wages have continued to go down and they expect you to work for free because they might close the factory. This is kind of it. And they're saying, look, we need different streams of income. We need different guarantees. We need to rewrite this contract a little bit. And, you know, from what I've also been told is, you know, staffing requirements. The fact that they're trying to get away with, you know, overworking these writers. You know, you want a job, don't you? And we see this across the board. It's just not writers. It's all of us, which is why I think this strike is one that we all better pay attention to. They're also talking about hours. You know, the fact that evidently what's going on is the seasons are getting shorter. It used to be in the old days you had, you know, 22, 25 episodes in a season, and that was almost a whole year. Now you've got some shows. There was one I saw on Netflix that got like 6 episodes. And they tie you into these exclusivity deals where you're stuck until they decide they don't need you anymore, which means that maybe you don't get the next gig. You know, a lot of us thought that, you know, these folks just work for the studio, they're on staff, they get paid, and they get paid no matter what. No, 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 silly us. And, you know, the thing is, as I said, wages, hours, conditions, you expect that. But where I think this strike is different, where I think this moment is different and why everyone should be paying attention is they're also talking about new technology and what AI is going to mean for these writers, because here's the reality. There's going to be a moment where ChatGPTs or whatever is going to be just writing people's scripts. The art of writing will go away. And this is the Writers Guild saying, you know what, we're going to protect our craft. We're going to protect our people. We're going to protect the industry. And I think that's really important because our legislative leaders, they really haven't. And this is something that I've been talking about for over a decade now. You know, as a truck driver, I've been saying, look, I know at some point in my lifetime, there are going to be autonomous vehicles on the road that are going to take jobs of working people. And once that happens, there's no going back. What we know is truck driving is the number one industry for high school educated white men. You take that away, what are you going to replace it with? Now, President Biden, you know, today the story is they're racing to upgrade the government's AI expertise and their role in regulating this, calling the leading architects of the AI world to Washington to talk about some guardrails and how we're gonna deal with this now. And I look, about damn time. I've been waiting for this for quite some time because we have almost nothing regulatory on AI. Nothing on the books. I don't think there's anything, and honestly. As where the EU, you know, they've been doing a bunch of things. And it's going to get really interesting come campaign season with all the deep fakes that we've been waiting for. And I'll tell you, they are scary good. But there's got to be some legislative movement. And I said yesterday, I have no faith in our political system right now because everyone's got their pet issue. They're getting their 15 seconds of fame over at the F channel or wherever. And I just don't see that there's going to be a way forward, although everyone should be concerned because it's going to harm all of us at some point. No one is immune. So if you're sitting there going, well, my job's safe, I don't have to worry about AI. Oh, well, I'm in the medical field. Yeah, you're number one on the list. They've been getting rid of you know, people reading x-rays and reading MRIs and that stuff for quite some time. And I do see at some point down the road, doctors, you're going to be frontline doctors. You're going to be extinct. Don't need you. We can have you talk to a robot, an AI robot, and you'll tell them and they'll tell you what's wrong with you. The only time you'll see a person in the brave new world, if it's something really complicated that needs a whole bunch of inputs. And even then, I don't know. They're also talking about if you work on Wall Street or in any kind of finance, insurance, or any of this stuff, risk management, fraud detection, any of this, you could be gone too. Lawyers, you know, how hard is it to write up a will? The AI bot will do it. And like I said, transportation, the trucking industry, you're screwed. Anything driving, shuttle drivers at the airport, bus drivers, all potentially gone. And I'm not even talking about manufacturing that I'm promoting coming back, because we need manufacturing jobs. But if they're all going to be done by robots and AI, why bring them back? And even, your retail clerks, your fast food industry, all of this stuff, education. South Korea a decade ago put a robot in front of a classroom. I mean, there's just so much, customer service. I mean, already I'm getting the robocalls of people who they sound almost real. There's so much. Construction. Look, I've been telling my kids, learn a trade, learn to build something. Even in the construction industry, McKinsey did a report back in 2017 that said that construction firms could boost their productivity by 50% using AI. And how would they do it? Well, they've got the Spot Dog. They literally can have a robot dog walk around and keep an eye on things, evaluate progress, make sure people are working, scan the job site. Now, they're going to argue, it's for safety. No, it's to keep an eye on you. And look, we've already got technology to spy on every move you make. Humans are eventually going to be the robots. And here's the thing. We're told that AI is going to have some job loss. It's going to happen. But the new jobs, they're going to be great. We just need to educate people. We need to get them the skills that they need, skills that are high in demand. Like critical thinking. Have you looked around? Problem solving, creativity, like the writers do. Yeah, like the writers do. I know, but Rick, we've heard this before. We've heard it before a bunch of times. And my thing is we end up in this world. We end up in this world where every time there's a technological change, and we could call it an improvement, you can call it whatever it is, a disruption. Every time there's a move forward, who takes it on the chin? Who's the one who gets screwed? Every major societal advancement has come at the expense of working people. That frictional period from the onset of the technology to the widespread benefit has caused chaos for the toiling class. That's you and me. That's people who show up to work every day. We've gone through a number of industrial revolutions. You go back to the mid-1700s when steam power was invented. Steam trains, textile mills, all of this stuff, bringing people off the farms and out of the countrysides into towns and into factories. And what happened? Well, people suffered. People suffered. They got stuffed into those factories. Unskilled labor. Cheap. Abundant. Exploitable. Working 6 days a week. 14, 15 hours a day. Even the kids got to come to work. 14, 15 hours a day. And that happened for much of the 20th century. When steam power got us to move things around differently and build things differently, major disruption. And who took it on the chin? The working people. They're the ones who got screwed. They're the ones who got stuffed into those sweatshops and those factories to eke out an existence. And then we had the second industrial revolution, when mass production became the thing, Henry Ford and the assembly line, and again, stuffing people in the factories. In 1800, just 6% of people in this country lived in cities. That means the other 94% lived in the countryside. They lived off the land. They made their own way. 100 years later, that number jumped to 40% living in cities. There was a massive influx because people had to survive. They thought, hey, we're going to go to the factories, and the factories are going to pay us wonderfully. And all they got was screwed over. And what you saw happen was, they finally came together. And they started organizing and said, you know what? There's a lot of wealth that our labor creates. We should have some of it. We should demand some of it. And that lasted till about the 1950s, when the next industrial revolution, the digital age, radio, TV, computers, that kind of stuff. And we were living in that just a little bit ago. Massive disruptions, though. Hundreds of thousands of people laid off, lost jobs, jobs gone, buggy whips, vacuum tubes, all that stuff. People got left behind. And in every one of these, it's the same thing. Well, you need to get new skills. You need to invest in yourself. And yet each one of these, it gets harder and harder for working people to keep up. And now here we are in this AI revolution, in this brave new world of robotics who, I don't know if you've been paying attention to some of this stuff, but it is scary. And very soon, quite frankly, can replace any one of us at any time. And this is why we have to have politicians and a moment where we go, either we've got to stop this for the short term until we figure it out so we can catch up, or you better work really quick. Now, as I said 10 years ago, I said there should be a technology tax. You want to implement a self-driving vehicle? Fine. It's going to cost you the salary plus index to inflation for however long you've replaced somebody. Somebody in their 30s, you're going to pay 40 years of this tax, and then you can use it however you want. But we're going to have to make this stuff a little more expensive to implement, or we're going to have massive chaos. And I'm sorry, I just don't have much faith in our political system right now to catch up. I do want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you have a job that you think, no, they couldn't possibly do without me? I'm special. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Dick Durbin, Senate Judiciary Chair. Interesting statement. He told Steve Scully that he read this morning's bit on Clarence Thomas. Evidently, Clarence is taking more money. They're finding more. And here's the thing. There is someone finally going after the Supreme Court. I don't know who it is, but there is someone clearly with enough information, because it's coming out every single day, something new. And it's about time. I've been talking about this for a while, that they should wear, NASCAR patches on their robes. We find out today, though, that Clarence has a grandnephew that they were raising him, him and Ginny, or maybe they were just, I'm not quite sure the dynamics, but the kid was in a private school, and a couple of the very top elite private schools in the country. the Hidden Valley Lake, the Hidden Lake Academy, a private boarding school in the foothills of North Georgia. Evidently, Harlan Crow, the guy who took him on a $500,000 vacation, lets him fly on his private jet. Evidently, Harlan paid the tuition. And what we find out is tuition at this boarding school, at this private academy, $6,000 a month. $6,000 a month. And, you know, that's the second one, evidently, that Harlan paid for, because evidently the kid went to this Randolph-Macon Academy in Virginia. I'm not sure why he got out of that and went to the other one. Not sure. But we find out that Harlan paid for both. And that one was $5,000 a month. And first my mind went, because this is how my mind works. First, I got to get different friends. Second, I'm thinking about the private schools and all of my voucher advocate friends who go, we're going to be able to send our kids to private schools. They're going to be great. We're going to be just like rich people. We can send our kids to private schools, you know, like the Hidden Lake Academy. I'm going to send them to Hidden Lake Academy. Only $6,000 a month. Problem is the golden ticket, the voucher that they give out is only about a month, maybe a month and a half of tuition. Who makes up the other, seven and a half months? Who does that? You do. Because we all don't have a Harlan Crow. And again, I don't want to get off on a rant with the vouchers, but the vouchers are only to give Harlan Crow a little bit more money because he's already paying. But here's the thing, and this isn't the only story with Justice Thomas. Evidently, we also find out that Leonard Leo, the Federalist Society guy, somehow had arranged for Jenny, because Jenny needed something to do. You know, she didn't want to take up, you know, social like kind of stuff and gardening or stuff like that. She needed a purpose. So they figured out how to get her a consulting gig where they're paying her, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for her consulting. And that her name was left off the billing paperwork. So they're paying her, basically paying her under the table. I got to think that there's something there that's wrong, don't you think? I know, but, you know, hey, Rick, what do you have against people working? Nothing. As long as they're not robbing us blind. And this is the world that we're in right now, where our politics are so drenched in money that you and I, we never get a fair shake. Which is why I keep saying we need publicly funded elections. We need to outlaw corporate money. We need to make real penalties for people who violate campaign finance laws. And we need to make sure that this stuff stops. These people are lining their pockets with the kind of wealth that most of us can't even imagine. And yet they're the ones who are supposed to decide on the things that affect our daily lives. These are the people that we put in charge to decide really important issues. Yeah, but Rick, you know, they need their rest and leisure. They need to make sure their kids get to go to the best schools. Does it not appear, I mean, from the outside, does it not appear that there's something seriously wrong here? And this is where, you know, I keep talking about saving public education. Because it's the one thing that we have that we can control, that we can hold on to, that we can strengthen. And yet they keep throwing all these, you can have vouchers and charter schools and cyber charters and we get all these different schemes. And look, the crazy right-wing religious people, they want to pump out as many units as possible and then us pay them to educate them at home. That's the goal. That's the whole, that's the wet dream wish list. All the while taking from your kids and mine. Taking from public education because they hate public education. So whenever they come to you and go, oh, it's all about destroying that one shot your kids got. Sad stuff.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1948. That was the day United Electrical Workers voted to strike at Univis Lens Company in Dayton, Ohio. Univis made safety lenses and instrumental optics. The UE was well established in the area manufacturing plants. Once organized, Univis fought the UE's presence at every chance they could. When the contract expired at the end of April, Univis refused to negotiate. First came the injunctions limiting picketing. This was followed by a vigorous decertification campaign. Foremen made intimidating personal visits to workers' homes, offering raises and personal loans to coerce no votes. When the UE lost the election in late July, the company announced wage increases for returning workers and firings for the remaining strikers. Workers stuck together and the strike continued. By the 26th, police swamped the picket lines, beating top UE organizers and arresting hundreds. 2 days later, the company offered a settlement for all but 11 strikers. The members refused. Then, the House Un-American Activities Committee came to town to begin a red-baiting inquisition of the UE district. The city's unions were outraged at the beatings and arrests. They walked off their jobs to bolster the picket lines and were met with tear gas. Governor Herbert called in the National Guard on August 2nd. 1,500 troops rolled into town in Sherman tanks with machine guns trained on the strikers. Scabs were escorted through plant gates between rows of fixed bayonets. Area residents, furious at the virtual martial law, flooded the governor with angry protests until troops were finally withdrawn. The strike ended in victory, with workers winning most of their demands. All but five were reinstated, and by the following April, the NLRB voided the decertification election.
While the powers that be constantly warn us about foreign threats to our democracy from Russian trolls, TikTok, etc., there is scant coverage of an actual assault on our people's democratic liberties by forces on our own soil. It's coming from extremist right-wing Republican lawmakers who have autocratic control over more than a score of America's state governments. Their obscure anti-democracy weapon is called preemption, the dangerous power of state officials to nullify laws passed by local people. It's supposed to be used rarely, carefully, and only in emergency situations, but today's radical big government Republicans have weaponized it, routinely overturning local actions that the GOP's corporate funders don't like. Local decisions to protect worker safety, outlaw loan sharking, shut down puppy mills, prevent workplace discrimination, stop pollution, control political corruption, and so many more popular democratic reforms are being abolished by Republican autocrats in service to plutocrats. Some 500 more of these usurpations are moving through state legislatures across the country now, with practically no public notice. Embarrassingly, GOP leaders in my state of Texas have been leading this charge against the people's democratic will, and they're now enacting a nuclearized escalation of their attack. Their new weapon has been dubbed Death Star, a state law that will preemptively ban cities and counties from passing corporate regulations stronger than state regulation, which is infamously feeble. The ban, gleefully pushed by a horde of lobbyists for brand-name corporate elites, includes letting corporations overturn existing local protections. This is Jim Hightower saying, "This is a wholesale usurpation of your and my liberty to govern ourselves. In exchange for political funding, GOP officials are literally outsourcing the people's democratic authority." Learn more at supportdemocracy.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Jeffrey Toobin has a new book. You know, when I saw the headline, Jeffrey Toobin's got a new book, my first thought was, you know, how not to use Zoom. That was kind of my first thought, or, you know, make sure that, you know, you're clothed, or, you know, make sure you know where the mute button is, or I don't know, something along that line. But this one's actually kind of, I think, going to be kind of interesting. It draws a direct line from the homegrown terrorism of the Timothy McVeigh era straight to January 6th and puts the orange guy in the middle of it. I think could be an interesting book in here to share some thoughts on. Maybe what Toobin, I don't know. I'm still struggling with the Tubin thing. What the book could do and what we should be looking forward to. I've asked my good friend Sarah Burris to come share some thoughts with us. Sarah's a reporter at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hello. Happy Thursday.
So Tubin's got a book. I thought Tubin was a verb. Now he's got a book.
Oh, he does have a book. And it's actually a really good one. It talks a lot about McVeigh's life and kind of how he became radicalized. And if you remember, like a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a story about how, like, sort of tying the fear that still exists in Oklahoma because of the bombing and how that has escalated now because guns are so readily available. And so, an act of mass destruction, of terrorism, is easily accomplished with an AR-15. And so what Tubin does is he draws that line between, you know, the radicalization through the far right of Timothy McVeigh and how that has continued since the Oklahoma City bombing and into the January 6th incident, and how they're all the same ideologies.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is I remember the McVeigh era, and I remember that a lot of the militia groups actually turned him in, and they knew how bad this was. I look at that subculture, or whatever you want to call them, today, and I don't think that is them at all.
No, definitely not. I think what's interesting too is like seeing obviously the Proud Boys verdict today, you know, kind of brings all of that together too, because you're looking at, you know, there were people that were there on January 6th who wanted to do crazy harm, like who really genuinely wanted to overthrow the government, which goes back to that McVeigh piece. And then there were just the people who were hacked off about the Trump stuff. And I think trying to understand the difference between those two and how they can make the easy jump from being hacked off about the election to being ready to overthrow the government, you know, is a helpful piece for looking at where we're going in the future and how to stop it.
Yeah. Now you brought up the convictions today of this Henry Enrique Tarrio, who is pictured with virtually every Republican at some
yes.
point or another. And these three other idiots, they were guilty of seditious conspiracy. This is a big freaking deal. My question is this being a big freaking deal, we now have traitors who have been convicted. When do we do Scott Perry? When do we do Ginny Thomas? When do we do, you know, name the Freedom Caucus member, name the right-wing extremist. When do we do them next?
That is the question, because this is the piece of it where you look at these people who were convicted of seditious conspiracy and it's like, well, they weren't just conspiring with themselves. Right. There's somebody else out there that they were conspiring with. And one of the biggest problems is that they, you know, really tried to get Tarrio to give some information about Donald Trump, to basically give him up, where they're just like, look, you know, if you take us to Trump, if you tell us what involvement he had in this, then, you know, you make it out of spending the rest of your life in prison. Otherwise, you're going to get charged with seditious conspiracy and you're going to, you know, be found guilty and get 20 years. So, you know, maybe think about it. And Tarrio talks about it and he's just like, you know, no, I wouldn't give him up. And so I think that there is now a question for these guys who basically are looking at jail in the face, you know, spending the rest of their lives in jail, and they got to decide, like, what are you going to do, man?
Yeah, or a good portion of it. Now, how much do you think is, you know, they think that Trump's going to come back into the presidency and he's going to pardon everybody because, you know, he's so reliable and dependable in that way.
I would not put all of my eggs in one basket.
I wouldn't put any eggs in that basket.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either. I would keep all of my eggs in a completely separate basket, perhaps in another state.
Yeah, one that allows for abortion.
Excuse me. Sorry.
But you know, here's the thing. You know, I saw this quote today that, you know, the Justice Department has won every single case that they've brought against the January 6th criminals, either fully or partial convictions, 100%. They haven't lost anything. They haven't lost one Not a single one.
I think that's because they've done a lot of plea deals, and I think that they've convinced people that they're not screwing around. And you know, when they do that sort of overcharging thing where it's like, I'm going to show you what we can give you, and then you tell us what you're willing to do to like plead that down. I think that is really for the folks who were not in a militia, right? For the folks who were just there because they were Trumpers, they were MAGA people. I think that was a rude awakening to them.
Because there are differences. I mean, the idiots and the dupes who just walked in and maybe took a dump on the floor or leaked on someone's desk. Those are just a bunch of idiots, opportunists, people caught up in the Trump moment. But it's the Tarios and these other ones who plotted and planned and schemed and were part of a much bigger picture. Because I see this in two very different ways. Look, if you were in the Capitol, you deserve something. But I want to know where the money came from. I want to know who planned it. I want to know so much more that we're not getting. And I fear this is the level where it ends.
Well, hope it's not. Because the thing is especially with the Proud Boys, we know who paid for their stuff. Like, the records are there. We know that came from the Publix lady in Florida. She gave them their plane. I mean, all of that information is available. So I don't understand why, you know, if you were robbing a bank and you just drove the car while everybody else robbed the bank, you still get charged, right? Like, if you paid these guys to rob the bank, you still get charged, right? So it seems like all of that should apply here too. And I don't know the extent to which the Justice Department is ready to take that up to the next notch, or, you know, if that's going to fall under the rubric of the special counsel. Like, I don't know.
You brought up the special counsel, and evidently there's a possibility, and this blew my mind today, there's a possibility of some missing video footage. My mind harkens back to Richard Nixon and the 18 minutes of missing audio. How much missing video do you think there is?
Right. That's a big question. But you remember the news story, it was a couple of weeks, I guess, after, or maybe a couple of months after January 6th. And we found out that there were no phone calls going in or out of the White House between, you know, that time of the insurrection. And everybody was like, who believes that?
Yeah, they were using burner phones.
Right. This really kind of felt like that to me, that piece of it. And so the thing is that you look at some of this stuff and tech really, like, you have to know what you're doing to get something to disappear nowadays. You know, because folks can bring stuff back. And so I really hope that is, you know, that we just need a really good nerd to figure out where this stuff went.
But the thing is, I know it wasn't Donald Trump up at 3 o'clock in the morning figuring out how to do it. He paid somebody. and to me, there's always the hope then that someone gains a conscience and says, yeah, this is what I did and this is why it was done. Because I still think that the classified documents, I still think it was the Secret Service who turned them in. That's where my mind still kind of is.
Well, I mean, I definitely, that's a piece of it. I think what happened with that is the National Archives were like, wait a minute, we don't have all that stuff that you've been talking about that you've had, you know, like the letters from Kim Jong-un and stuff like that. And they were just like, wait a minute, we don't have that. So what else do we not have? And I think that began all of it. And I think the Secret Service, when they were called in to testify, were just like, yeah, no, I'll tell you anything.
As they should. You listen to The Rick Smith Show here with Sarah Burris. Sarah's a reporter at Raw Story. RawStory.com, the website, if you want to check out her work. I want to change topics today, as I started the day off with 11,500 writers and producers, members of the Writers Guild, are on strike against the Hollywood studios. And, you know, it's wages, hours, conditions, that stuff that you would expect. But also this AI thing is, I've been saying that this is the strike we have to watch, because this is really, in my view, the first time that we're seeing, you know, right before our eyes, someone pushing back against AI and the job losses that could come. I'm curious your thoughts.
So the AI piece and the streaming piece are the most important part, because you look at movies that say, you know, a writer wrote 10 years ago And it used to be that, like, they got a penny out of every DVD sale or a penny out of every VHS sale. Remember those? Now, if they're streaming, there's no deal in place for that because streaming didn't exist back then. So for anybody who is a writer who wrote something, you know, more than 10 years ago, like, they're getting screwed.
Yeah, you're out of
luck. And so that is a big piece of this that I think folks really need to, I think folks will understand a lot better. The AI piece of it, I go back and forth on because I think AI will improve enough where you can basically put in the ideas for, you know, this is what the story, the construct of a story that I want, write it for me. I have not had any luck with ChatGPT about anything. I can give it a link to a Washington Post story and tell it to write me a story off of that story, and it gets every single one of the facts wrong. And so, and I keep testing it. Like, every week I try something new where it's just like, here, look at this video that has a transcript with it. Tell me what this is about. And it tells me something that is just like about the commercial that was, that ran before it. And it's just like, wow, this is really bad. This is really, really terrible.
See, my experience now is the opposite. I mean, I'm just goofing around with it. You know, I wanted to know how wonderful I am. So I put in, you know, why is Rick Smith wonderful? And it came up with, you know, they've been doing the show for X amount of time, nationally recognized, you know, syndicated all these. It got a lot right. And it was just off of, you know, just a couple of words. And I'm going, wow, that's frightening.
And I think that is the difference between me writing for my purposes and fiction writers, right? Like, they can put in the categories necessary and it's going to spit out something. I need something very specific with correct information. Right. And I just don't think it can do that. But if you want to ask it to make a poem or a haiku about your cousin and his incessant belching, that does really well. Yeah. It made it the best haiku ever.
Now, what you do is a lot of analysis. So right now, the technology is not there yet. And that's the scary part in all of this. You know, there was something that, you know, I agree with Tucker Carlson on. You know, I had a listener not too long ago sent me a thing where he's saying that he's against, you know, automated trucks being on the road because of the job losses. And I'm against a lot of this stuff because of the massive job losses and how it's going to harm working people, because every one of these, call it whatever you want, industrial type revolutions, technology, you know, increases in technology, it's always working people who take it on the chin.
It is. And the problem that we have had in moving into that next era, particularly with us in the last generation, is that we don't have the things in place to help people move on, you know, to gain the skills necessary to then move up to a different kind of job. And it used to be that when you were moving on from, like, you know, the shirtwaist factory to the whatever else, you know, that there were that companies were developing people. They were giving folks the training and the skills necessary to do those jobs. And now it's like nobody cares. And we have to rely on the government for that. But with Republicans in office, they don't care about workers. They don't care about people. They care about corporations.
No.
So they think it's going to just trickle down.
No, in fact, you know, right now, thanks to Republicans, and I'm glad you brought this up, you know, there is no trade adjustment assistance anymore. They let that expire. And the fact, if you lose your job because of bad trade deals, you're now SOL. And there is nothing in place to where if you lose your job through automation. And there should have been a decade ago. I've been calling for this for over a decade now, going, there's got to be some kind of technology tax in place to make sure that people don't fall through the cracks, to make sure we don't have another generation of, like, steelworker friends I had who, you know, back in the 80s were making $50,000, $60,000 a year. Those jobs went away, and then they get retrained to be a textile worker, which those jobs went away. It's insane what we've done to working people in trying to patch things together instead of making them whole.
And this is the thing where I feel like we should talk more about Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans world of their economic policy, that where they say that they believe in this populism, they believe in everyday Americans. Trump talked a whole lot about trade. But then when you actually have the results from what has been done, you know, it's like, you know, you can tell me what you think, but show me what you've done.
Exactly.
And they have done nothing.
No, they've done nothing. A lot of nice tweets, though. A lot of funny pictures. A lot of funny pictures. Him driving a truck. Still my all-time favorite. Him driving the truck, looking all goofy, and him yelling at the kid cutting the grass. I mean, we got lots of fun photos, but no actual policy. And this is where, again, those 4 years were lost, and we're further behind because of it.
Yeah, we are. And I mean, from my perspective, I really, really love driving. I think driving is the best thing ever. So I'm never going to be one of those people that like wants an automated car. I'm going to be like speeding around those people being like, get out of my way. So
see, now I'm looking forward to automated vehicles down the road. When I'm too old and I can't drive, I can still get places. That'll work. I assume
that's why you breed, right? That's why you have children. You have them to clean your house and to drive you around when you're old. I can't
get the trash out. What are you talking about?
Oh my gosh.
Maybe you're right. So last question I've got for you, because I'm looking at this strike, and I'm thinking it's going to be a lengthy one. I've heard some talk, a couple of shows are, trying to, help their people through September, which seems a long way away. Any thoughts?
God, I hope it doesn't last that long. I mean, I appreciate the writers. I support all the writers. I absolutely hope that they get everything that they're demanding. I'm also a viewer, and I hate reality TV. I cannot watch that crap. Like, I don't know if it's just because I can't turn my brain off like that. Like, all of the screaming and throwing things at people, I just can't.
Yeah,
I can't do that. And so as a viewer, I'm just really hoping that they come back, because there's no way that I'm going to start canceling subscription services if they don't have anything new. Like, you should figure that out, Disney.
There's always that. I had someone email me today and say that the last writer's strike saved Trump from being canceled, and that we should blame the writers for Trump being president because he had gotten canceled. And I'm going, well, they're not entirely wrong, but I'm still supporting the writers in their strike and to get what they earn and to be treated with respect and to save their industry. I think this is an important fight that we have all got to pay attention to. But Sarah, I appreciate the time. As always, fabulous stuff.
Thank you so much. Have an awesome weekend.
You as well, our good friend Sarah Burris. Remember, make sure you check out her website, rawstory.com, and the work that she does there. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have a good talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That evening, a workers' rally in Chicago, Illinois, became known as the Haymarket Tragedy. On May 1st, workers across the city and around the country held massive rallies for the eight-hour workday. 2 days later, the police had fired into a crowd of workers on strike outside the McCormick Reaper plant in the Chicago neighborhood of Pilsen. Two workers were slain and many more were injured. Angry workers called a rally at the city's Haymarket Square to protest the police violence and to call for the eight-hour day. When the police attempted to disband the rally as it was ending, an unknown person threw a dynamite bomb into the ranks of the advancing police. In their confusion, the police began firing their weapons. A total of 7 policemen were killed and an unknown number of workers were struck. In the aftermath of the bombing, union offices and labor papers were raided throughout the city. 8 vocal supporters of the workers' movement were put on trial. 4 of the men, Albert Parsons, August Spees, George Engel, and Adolph Fisher, were sentenced to death by hanging. A 5th man, Louis Ling, died under mysterious circumstances in prison. Historian Bill Edelman explained the importance of Haymarket, saying, "No single event has influenced the history of labor in Illinois, the United States, and even the world more than the Haymarket affair. It began with a rally on May 4th, 1886, but the consequences are still being felt today." Although the rally is included in American history textbooks, very few present the event accurately or point out its significance. Throughout the world, the Haymarket martyrs are remembered, and May Day is celebrated as International Workers' Day. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So according to Gallup, thanks to all of the turmoil in the banking system because of the interest rates that are going through the roof, they say 48% of American adults say that they're concerned about their money. 19% are very, 29% say moderate. They're concerned about their money being in the banks. And this is one of those things that I actually don't worry about. I think FDI insurance is going to cover the meager amount of money that I've got in the bank. I don't think I'm going to lose the couple of grand I've got sitting in an account. Some of the other stuff, maybe. The stuff, you know, invested in Wall Street and my, you know, pensions and 401k and all that stuff. Yeah, that. But I'm not sure about the savings accounts and stuff. But where we're at is we're being pushed into this world where everything's under in turmoil. I got an email from Morris. That's weird. I got an email from Morris, and I got my next guest's last name is Morris, or his name's Morris. But Morris points out that there was a guy who died on a train in New York, and he said a 30-year-old guy was killed on a subway. Placed in a chokehold. Curious your thoughts about what happened. And this is one of those situations where I don't know what happened. I know what's being reported by the New York Times. I know what's being put out on social media. I'm seeing, you know, I'm seeing other stuff, and it's the extremes. You know, he was murdered. He was, he was a good guy. He was just, and they deliberately killed him. And then there's the other side of, he was trying to kill the other people. So there's these camps, and I haven't jumped into one of them because I don't know all the details. But what I do find interesting is everyone agrees that this guy was suffering from mental illness. He was homeless, and our systems failed him because we have a terrible track record in dealing with people who have struggles, whether they're homeless or mentally ill or whatever. Anybody in our society who is struggling, we have a terrible track record, and we've gotten worse over the generations. Desperation breeds desperation. Desperate people put in desperate situations do desperate things. And the thing is if there's a lack of humane solutions, inhumanity is going to fill the void. That's how I see this. We haven't taken care of the homeless, and we should be. And I've had people say, well, what should we do with them? I'm going, well, house them. Find them someplace. If they're mentally ill, get them treatment. If they refuse treatment, sorry, you're going to have to go back to what we were doing in the old days, pulling people into institutions to be treated. And then follow-up care when you get them out into the general population. You cannot have, and look, I've been on subways where people are acting the fool. I've been on public transit where people are just doing, you know, insane things where you go, you know, nobody to take care of this. Now, whenever this happens, I generally try and de-escalate the situation. I ignore them. I move away. But sometimes you don't have a choice. And again, I don't know what happened here. And from what I understand, a bunch of people on the train jumped in, and it was this one guy, this 24-year-old Marine, who put this guy in a chokehold because he thought, I'm just going to put him to sleep because I see it on wrestling. And you have someone who is not trained in de-escalation. You got someone who's trained as a soldier, having to deal with a desperate situation. So for me, I'm not going to take a position until I have all the facts yet, but this is a failure of we the people to take care of our own. This is a failure of having, well, decent solutions to horrible problems or any solution. I want to hear your thought. email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
If this is happening in April, what's it going to be like in June?
Spain broils in unprecedented heat wave while Italy's rivers dry up. EU adopts what's being described as the biggest climate protection law of all time. Plus, New York officially be...
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.